Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all today. Nothing like change, huh? This time of year, it comes fast and furious. The phrase comes to mind, change and decay, and all around I see, but that doesn't all apply here. Don't see any decay this morning, and that's good. The seasons are changing, and the scenery is changing, and hopefully the politics are changing soon. here's hoping. Good to have Josiah with us this morning. Missed him at the retreat this week, or last week, rather. And so glad he got to spend a little bit of time at home. Yeah, things have changed probably some in Salem since you've been here. The house next to Mom, Dad, Bailey about burned down, and who knows what else. We don't notice it because we kind of live here, but when you come back, you see those things. Well, we're still in Isaiah. That hasn't changed, and so chapter 47 here. We are making progress, though. And 47 is the chapter we'll be focusing on this morning. When I first read through this, I'm like, wow, this is going to be, I don't know, a little tough going. But it's actually another pretty incredible chapter. Isaiah's awesome, really, when you dig into him. It's just quite interesting. But you do have to dig a little sometimes. I'm going to start out by reading the last verses here of chapter 46 to give us a little bit of context. He says, remember the former things of old. Okay, and so usually whenever you see that phrase in Isaiah, it is God asking the Israelites to think back on how he has led them through history. Think about their beginnings. Think about the amazing things he has done in the past. Remember the former things of old. For I am God, there is none else. I am God, there is none like me. Declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done. Saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Calling a ravenous beast from the east, a ravenous bird from the east, the man who that executeth my counsel from a far country, speaking of Cyrus, apparently. Yea, I have spoken it, I will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it, I will also do it. Hearken unto me, ye stout-hearted, that are far from righteousness. I will bring my righteousness. It shall not be far off, and my salvation shall not tarry. And I will place salvation in Zion for Israel, my glory. Okay. And, you know, throughout his writing, you see this constant comparison, contrast, this pitting of positions one against another, this wordplay at times. And so here in these last two verses, listen unto me, you that are stout-hearted, that are far from righteousness. I will bring my righteousness, and it will not be far. My justice, my judgment on the earth. You may be a long ways from it. I'll bring it to you. It will be present. And it will not wait. I will place salvation in Zion for Israel, my glory. Now, I just want to point out one thing. We've talked various times how that we've had 100 years or so of commentators who have all chosen to look at the book of Isaiah as something which was largely written, at least in its prophetic content, largely written after the facts. And why is that? Well, you can't foretell the future. So it had to be, clearly. And so it's interesting. There's a passage here in earlier in chapter 46, which speaks of the gods of Babylon being carried about by beasts, that they be bowed down. They have gone into captivity. And the thing is, the immediate specifics of the captivity of Babylon, its takeover by Cyrus the Great, didn't involve the destruction of its gods. Okay, so it was a peaceful takeover, and Cyrus presented himself as being the liberator of the city, as the friend of the gods, so on and so forth. And so those same commentators that say, well, you can't foretell the future, say, well, Isaiah got this wrong. Okay, it didn't happen this way. But if he's not foretelling the future, what did he get wrong? That's kind of funny. But the fact is, this is not a specific prediction of what will happen to Babylon at the redemption of Israel. This is a discussion of idolatry in general. This is typically what happens anytime a pagan city falls. Their idols get carried away on donkeys by their captors. And so Isaiah is not trying to tell you exactly what's going to happen to Babylon at the time of the redemption of Israel this time around. But it's just interesting how that those that espouse that notion that prophecy is not possible then complain that Isaiah got this wrong. Well, that's funny. Anyway, so the closing of this chapter is this statement again of the position of God, who he is, and in comparison to all else, they are nothing. Chapter 47, then, is a chapter which, it portrays the coming fall of Babylon, but not with an eye to just giving you a blow by blow and all the details. It paints the picture in graphic scenes of the change in position, the change in status. I want to read to you here a piece from John Oswald, where he's actually quoting from another position stated by another commentator. He says, the observation that chapter 47 is an oracle against the nations is an important confirmation of the point that Alexander makes. Okay, so just to get yourself thinking here, whenever you start analyzing ancient literature, one of the things you ask is, well, what is the purpose of this piece? What is it trying to do? And so it's one thing to just generally talk about where the rest of the world stands in relation to God and what will in general kind of happen. It's another thing to make very specific predictions about how it will happen or when it will happen or who will be involved. Okay, so those are two different ways to talk about things that are to come. And so he's saying here that this chapter is not trying to give you a blow by blow. It's describing major changes in status. Okay, so he says chapters 40 through 48 do not have their chief purpose, the prediction of the fall of Babylon in 539. And this is not the climax, chapter 47, that is. This is not the climax of that prediction. Rather, the point of these chapters is to teach the absolute power and unceasing grace of God, using the particular backdrop of the exile and return to illustrate the point. So, for Isaiah here, yes, there will be a destruction of Babylon. Yes, there will be a return. Yes, God will bring about a redemption. But this is more about who he is in general. This is more about the big picture rather than just revealing to you specifics. Thus, this chapter was not designed as a specific prediction any more than chapter 14 was designed for that purpose. So, in your spare time, you can go back and read chapter 14 and see what he's talking about there. Rather, it is another of Isaiah's graphic and concrete illustrations of one of the continuing points of the book. God is supreme, and no nation, however proud and glorious, can stand against him. Now, you might say, well, that's pretty obvious. Why didn't he just say that and be done with it instead of writing for 60-some chapters? Well, it may be obvious to us, but if you were alive in the 6th or 7th or 8th century B.C., and you were looking at the powers in the world, it might not be so obvious to you. It might not be so obvious when you see Assyria invading, first of all, the northern kingdom and destroying Samaria and coming up to your very doorstep and then going away miraculously. And then it might not seem so obvious whenever Babylon comes back and destroys the city and takes your people captive. You might wonder if maybe our ideas about God are somehow off a little bit. It's over. The covenant, if there ever was one, is terminated. Well, Isaiah's message is no. God is at work in this world, in spite of what appear to be the predominant forces, in spite of the fact that the Assyrians arrogated to themselves the attitude of absolute conquerors of the world and were supreme for a couple centuries or so. It doesn't matter that the Babylonians eventually conquered them and then rose to prominence and considered themselves to be at the top of the heap. Actually, God is bringing about his purposes through all that. And the only reason that Israel ever went into captivity was because of their forsaking the covenant, of their forsaking God. And so, this chapter then is more general in its condemnation of the arrogance of Babylon, which is just representative of many other nations, really. One after another, as they come to power, do the same thing. And so it starts out like this. Come down, sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground, there is no throne. O daughter of the Chaldeans, for thou shalt no more be called tender and delicate. Okay, so I don't know if you have thought recently about the kind of human experience that people who are considered to be royal sometimes experience. But it's different. I know you can't believe all the rumors that come out of palaces, but I read recently a report that the current king of England has some peculiarities, which I don't doubt in general. But for instance, he's so averse to certain types of common actions that he doesn't even squeeze his own toothpaste tube. Somebody has to squeeze that for him. That's different. You know, I hope they don't get too much. But whether that was just started by some malicious person trying to malign him or whether in fact that is true, I don't know for sure. But I am pretty sure that there are people in this world who, due to their privilege and their wealth, are able to command everybody else around and do very little for themselves, who consider themselves to be special, to be different, to be elevated, to be tender, to be delicate. And that's very different from the person who wakes up in the morning and has to drag themselves out of bed and make their own bed and brush their own teeth and all the things that we do every day to make things work. And so the picture here is a transition from this tender, delicate, elevated position to that of slave. So all the way from the top to the bottom. And so Isaiah says here, come down. You're elevated. You're way up here. You're above everything. Come sit in the dust. Verse 2, take the millstones, grind the meal. Okay, so in the ancient world, one of the most fundamental tasks that had to be done constantly was to turn the produce of the agriculture, wheat or barley, some kind of grain, to turn it into a usable form. I don't know if you've ever been out in a wheat field and when it was ripe and taken a handful and rubbed it together, got rid of all the chaff and chewed on it, but it's kind of cool to do once or twice. But it's not the kind of thing you do every day. And wheat usually has to be turned into bread of some form to be readily digestible and useful to us. And so it's a time-consuming, labor-intensive process of grinding that wheat into a more usable form. So as I understand it, grindstones come in all sizes and shapes, and at certain times in history, we've gotten smart enough that we could hook them up to a water wheel and make them kind of work theirself. But there wasn't much of that here at this time. And so you had a stone on the bottom, which was concave. It had a peg in the middle and a stone on the top, which was convex, and a hole in it. And you put the one on top of the other. And the hole was a little larger than the peg, as I understand. And so you pour grain in that hole, and you turn the top stone, and there's a little groove in the bottom stone that as you grind it, it works the flour to the outside. But you just basically turn one stone on top of the other with this grain falling down in between until you have enough. And that's work, right? If there's any way you want to look at it, that's work. And so it was the work of slaves. So, from the position of being on high, the position of being tender and delicate, and of course, metaphorically here, Babylon is compared to a female, a queen. And so, go from there, take the millstones, grind the meat, uncover thy locks. Okay, so take off thy veil. Another sign of royalty is you veil your beauty from the rest of the world. They're not worthy to gaze on your beauty, and so you cover it up, hide it from them. Here's it's exposed. You're just a slave. Make bare the leg, uncover the thigh, pass over the rivers. Okay, so these are more images, and you just kind of marvel sometimes when you think about how our world has changed. the irony of it, and sometimes the nonsense of it. But, you know, in our day, there seems to be a competition among celebrities to see how much they can uncover and still get away with it, or see how much praise they can get from how much they manage to uncover. Well, historically, that has not been a sign of honor, of beauty, of good. It's been a sign of shame. The naked body is not something you display for all the world to see. Hope that doesn't come as a jarring shock to you, but that's for most of the history of the world been the understanding. We've tried to turn most everything on its head, haven't we? We go to great extents to make people proud of their body, and there seems to be the concurring trend to do everything you can to expose it. Not only am I proud of it, but I want to show it to you. Well, that has led to all sorts of problems. It's something that if you focus on it, if you make it the most important thing, if you make it a point of pride, then a lot of people end up wanting to change it, right? I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but it would be interesting to know how much money the world spends every year on cosmetic surgery. And I'm not saying that every cosmetic surgery is wrong. There certainly are certain things that can happen to us, or things that we can be born with that life would work much better if they weren't that way. And that's something that you would have to judge between yourself and your, well, whatsoever is not of faith is sin. So between you and God, right? But if you make this a source of pride, that changes everything, right? If it's a source of pride and it's something that I'm almost compelled to show off, well, I'm much more compelled to do something about it, right? Instead of a position which says, you know what? The real you is not the shell you live in. You know, even if you have suffered extreme injury in life, the real you is beyond that. And my concern for you as a human being, my love for you as a human being, doesn't depend on your physical features. That should be a fundamental understanding in our world. Because really, you're not responsible for those things. Now, there are some things you are responsible for. You know, if you wake up in the morning and you fix your hair like this, and you walk out into the world, you're responsible for that. Okay. You don't have to do that. but I'm talking about physical body features that you didn't choose and you didn't create. And then, of course, you know, we've gotten to the point in our world where people are doing just really nasty things to themselves to get attention. It results in deformation of various body parts. And it's messed up. That's all it is. But anyway, throughout history, it has been a sign of shame to uncover your nakedness in public. And it still should be. So that's what Isaiah is referring to here. Thy nakedness shall be uncovered. Yea, thy shame shall be seen. I will take vengeance, and I will not meet thee as a man. Yes.
The last part of verse 2 there, pass over the rivers, I guess I was kind of combining that with the make bare the leg and cover the thigh, where they have to actually, you know, instead of being carried across on something because of privilege, actually have to hike up and actually get in the water across the river themselves. Is that what?
So there's a little bit of uncertainty about what that's referring to, but the region of southern Mesopotamia was a region that was, the agriculture was fed by a lot of irrigation. So you had channels cut, canals cut, and so if you're in the slave class and you're working, you're going to have to cross these things. And so it seems to be, I mean, you hit it by saying instead of somebody carrying you, you're going to have to do it on your own. So I think that probably, that intuition is probably accurate. This continues to speak of being a slave and having to navigate, literally, the ditches and the canals and everything on your own. And if you don't want to get your clothes wet, you got to lift them up, since nobody's going to be lifting you. Yes. So quite a change here from the tender and delicate phase. As for our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel. Okay, so continue in your mind to contrast the world that he's speaking into. So Babylon was a magnificent city. It had these huge stepped pyramid-type temples where their gods were worshipped in elaborate ceremonies. They had elaborate images, gold-covered. And compare that to the Israelites. So, you know, what did they have in their temple? Well, they had a box, right? The Ark of the Covenant. There was some gold, but they didn't have any huge image of their god. In terms of military might, they were zero in the wider world. They were of no significance in the minds of the Babylonians as having really any substance to speak of. And here's Isaiah saying, yeah, you've elevated yourself, and he'll continue to talk about how you've elevated yourself, but you're in this elevated position. Come down, sit in the dust. Our Redeemer is the Lord of hosts, the Holy One of Israel. And he continues throughout this work to portray God, the God of Israel, as being the one who is in fact in control of the course of history, as opposed to being insignificant, as opposed to being a nothing. He, in fact, is the center of it all. Now, put yourself for a minute in the place of Isaiah writing this stuff. I mean, he was either totally delusional, or else he was convinced of a reality which transcends the normal. And he didn't just say this once. He says it for 60-some chapters, right? And he does it in very eloquent ways. You're just struck by the power of his message and his life and his work. When you realize what it is he's saying in the face of the world that he lived in. I can't help reflect from time to time on the fact that one of the few Dead Sea Scrolls that was recovered virtually intact was the Isaiah Scroll. It was a work that had penetrated deeply into the minds of Jews that were looking for the redemption of Israel, and they went to great lengths to preserve it over the centuries. So, the Lord of hosts is his name. So, come down, sit in the dust. Verse 5, sit thou silent, and get thee into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for thou shalt no more be called the Lady of Kingdoms. I was wroth with my people. I have polluted my inheritance, and given them into thine hand. Thou didst show them no mercy. Upon the ancient hast thou very heavily laid thy yoke. And thou said, I shall be a lady forever, so that thou didst not lay these things to thy heart, neither didst remember the latter end of it. Okay. And so, I mean, this seems to be a quality of most every empire. The euphoria of having reached their pinnacle causes them to suppose that they'll stay there forever. You remember, perhaps most recently, historically, the Germans under Hitler proclaimed that they were beginning a Third Reich, a 1,000 years of rule. Well, how long did they make it? 2 or 3, maybe, depending on what you focus on. Didn't happen. But when you're at the peak and everything's going your way, everything's under your control, it's real easy to think, this could go on forever. Instead of looking at the history of things and realizing change and decay in all around I see. Therefore, hear now this, thou that are given to pleasures, that dwellest carelessly, that sayest in thine heart, I am, and none else beside me. Okay, so Isaiah portrays them as setting themselves as the substitute for the true I am. The transcendent, self-existent one, I am. And you say, I shall not set as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children. Okay, so these were two things that nightmares were made of in the ancient world. To be a woman and a widow means that you have no support. You're alone in the world. You're trying to make it by yourself. And you don't get to play even by the same rules that men play by. And so that is a horrible fate to imagine, to be widowed in this world. And then as well, to know the loss of children. Wow, what a different world we live in. But they were highly valued here. But these two things shall come to thee in a moment, in one day: the loss of children and widowhood. They shall come upon thee in their perfection for the multitude of thy sorceries. Okay, so perfection, being perfect, is a word we often stumble over both in New and Old Testament. So the Hebrews had a similar concept here to the Greeks. To say that something comes on you in its perfection means it comes on you completely, totally, okay, fully. He says it's for the multitude of thy sorceries. and for the great abundance of thine enchantments. So one thing that ancient Babylon is known for was its magic. And I don't do magic much. Don't suppose you do either. And so I'm not all that familiar with it, but there's an interesting bit here that I think will be helpful. It's actually connected to verse 10, but we're in that general vicinity. Oswald says, once again, we turn to Babylon's false security, but with the apparent intent of building on what was said in verse 9, which we just read. Why did Babylon feel secure in her wickedness? Because her great learning and wisdom had led her astray. Their mastery of the magical arts had led the Babylonians to believe that they understood the workings of the world so well that they were proof against any disaster, that is, that their understanding was. Undoubtedly, this factor also contributed to their pride and the insistence that there was no one else besides them. But what is meant by wickedness? One possibility is that it is the magical knowledge itself. Magic rests on the belief in continuity, that everything in the world is continuous with everything else. Therefore, all one needs to manipulate the world is knowledge of the nature of the particular connections. Thus, doing the proper rituals in the human realm has the automatic results in the realms of nature and the gods. So, if the weather is somehow connected to the divine world, and you need to control the weather, then you just need to know how to manipulate the divine world to get that done. That's what he means by continuity, this connection between all these things. Ethics is of no religious significance in such a world. Okay, so ethics concerns what's right and wrong. You know, when you start to consider, well, do I perform this action? If you're an ethical person, one of the first things that comes to your mind, well, is it the right thing to do? Is it the proper thing to do? Another way to say it, is it the moral thing to do? The world of magic doesn't consider ethics. It's just everything is connected, and if I know how to manipulate it, I do it. Right? What does it have to do with right and wrong? For biblical writers who knew that God is not part of this world and that ethics is at the heart of the divine human relationship, magic was not so much a mistake as it was an abomination. The other possibility is that since Babylon feels herself to be preeminent in magical wisdom and knowledge, she therefore does not have to bring her policies before any outside bar of right and wrong. She can do whatever she wishes, including what everyone else might call wickedness, and feel secure in it. She is above and beyond everyone else's standards. The parallel with Nazi Germany comes readily to mind, and it offers some illumination. Having declared that it was above such mundane matters as ethical accountability, that it was only accountable to itself for its destiny, Germany fell into the most horrifying kinds of wickedness. It appears that to deny the relevancy of ethical standards for oneself is not to leave oneself in a position of ethical neutrality, but to deliver oneself over to ethical evil. So it may have been for Babylon. In a verse just a little bit down, he quotes them as saying, Babylon, that is, no one sees me. This particular expression is the voice of ethical relativity. Such a position assumes that whatever I want is all right if I can get away with it. The idea that if something is right in the daylight, it is also right in the dark is foreign to such thinking. In this context, the implication may also be that there is no one higher than I who is in a position to judge my actions. So, I don't know if that fills in your notions or your understanding any better of magic and how it works. One of the things that we have unfortunately inherited from the Babylonians are various notions about astrology, as distinguished from astronomy, both of which they were interested in and connected the two. But, you know, astrology is very much a dabbling in this magical notion about the nature of reality. The idea that somehow if I'm born in a certain time period, then I'm connected in a special way to the world, to the universe, to the stars. And so you have people who want to read their horoscope regularly to know whether this is a good time to start a relationship or to start a business or to go out for an adventure. If I would expect to have success in what I do if I do it now, on the basis of when I was born and what the position of the stars is. Now, we chuckle at that, I hope. But there are people who don't, and there have always been people who didn't. And of course, I always hesitate to say this. I started to say, before we knew as much as we know now about the universe, and yet almost every day that I live, I get more evidence that we don't know what we thought we did and that there's so much more that we don't. So I say that with tongue-in-cheek kind of thing, realizing that, okay, I think we know more than the ancients, but to say that we understand it is a far shot. Anyway, we have cast off some degree of the superstitions that often possessed ancient men about the sky. The idea that they were gods, the stars were, or that they somehow controlled us in our decisions and our destiny. Most people don't hold to that on a regular basis. But if you don't have anything to pin your hopes on, and there are wise men in your world which seems to know so much, then you might be tempted to listen to them. If you really, really care about a relationship, or if you're wanting to go to war and you want to do it at the right time so you win, and there's anything that will give you an advantage, you'll probably go with it, right? Let's not take any chances here. The stars might have something to do with it. Isaiah says, this is nonsense. It is the God of Israel that's in control of the stars, that's in control of all things. He is the Lord of all. And his relationship with human beings is not based on fancy rituals that you have to do just right or else he's mad. His relationship is based on an ethical life that he asks you to live.
Mr. Keith?
Yes.
Listening to that description of magic is interesting, because to me it sounded a lot like a modern view of science. Basically, there is a connection between everything in the world and things that humans do in the human realm can control their surroundings, the weather, nature. So
maybe I'm wrong here, but it seems like the difference, it's easy to look back, and I don't think this is what you're doing, but it's easy to look back and think, you know, back when they were superstitious, like you mentioned, we still don't know what's going on in the universe, but like, it seems like modern magicians basically are just the ones who feel more confident about getting a good result. That you have people who still are taking actions in the human realm and assuming that it can control nature and the elements. And because there are hundreds and thousands of years of study that show that it often works and it can be repeatable, and there's the scientific method, which honestly is a great way of finding how to do things repeatably and how they can make sense, then you have a more successful version. But to all intents and purposes, you still have a lot of people who are just trying to control their life, their surroundings, and saying that what they find in that attempt to control can prove about the nature of the universe, whether there is anything in the divine realm. To me, it just sounded very similar, which I thought was interesting.
And ultimately, what they're attempting to control is their fellow man. Mm-hmm. Right? There are so many aspects of the universe that are beyond our reach. And yet, if we can pose as the knowers, we know. And we can control at least on this level. Then you should listen to us. You should let us control your life. And I think you're absolutely right that what we see in many people's, in the practical sense, science has become, you could say, the god. It has become analogous to the world of magic, that is the substitute for God. And it is not ethically based. It's not an ethically based system. So it should be seen for the contrast that it is to the God of the Bible.
So much of the atrocities that the Nazis did were in the name of science.
Absolutely.
The progression of man.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Without ethics, it could get very dark very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen, pure... not ethics, not the right word for it, but the sciences and the humanities need each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because purely going on the soul without any logic or reason behind it gets off course pretty quick too.
Mm-hmm. At any rate, I think hopefully we can see how relevant the issues that Isaiah is dealing with here is. How relevant the issues are to our world, and we haven't moved that far. We really haven't moved that far. So, we're out of time.
60 or 70 years ago, whatever it was, when C.S. Lewis wrote some of this stuff, but especially the A Hideous Strength, and talking about how being governed by experts, that was really the consolidation of power and really everything being controlled by experts in their various fields, devoid of ethics, basically. And anyway, so in that country, at least, he was seeing it earlier, but we see much the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think part of the insight he had there was that even the experts are controlled by often a sinister force. There's just this consensus that, well, this is what we have to do because this is the accepted truth. Very well. I haven't heard the bell, but I'm sure that it's imminent. it really is ironic to think about what scientists would think about us seeing parallels between magic and science.
Thank you.
Again, I love to go over the lyrics of a song before I sing them, and this one is a devotional all in itself. You could spend a good amount of time thinking about this. If you would like to, as I sing, it's in the celebration hymnal, page 606, if you'd like to follow along with the words. You know, when you bring new life into the world, you start thinking, at least I did, started thinking a little more seriously about a lot of things. And this obviously is nothing new or whatever with us. But I realized that three primary questions that we come into this world wanting to understand and not having a clue about is what is good, what is true, and what is beautiful. We don't have a clue. And those things can only be found in God. And yet, that's our primary job, is to kind of point people, especially our children, but then the world, to the truth that is found in God, to the goodness that he says is, the things that he says is good are good. Things that he says are beautiful are beautiful. And we don't have a clue what those things are, and the world is shoving in our face constantly a different reality. And what seems natural to us oftentimes is not what is truly good, what is truly beautiful, what is truly right. And so in going over this song, it was like, wow, the whole theology of those things that God is can be found in this song. The truth that his love will not let us go no matter how we feel. Because a lot of times we don't feel secure and loved. But the truth is, it is real. It will not let us go no matter what. The goodness that no matter what darkness comes into our life, he will bring good from it. That is a truth that we can stand on. That is what goodness is. And the beauty that who we are and the little bit that we bring, he will, in the light of Christ, make it into his image. It's amazing. So never get too far away from hymns, because they offer us so much theology that gives us strength and truth to walk in. I dare. rest.